Before you can achieve success in the higher and broader sense, you must gain such thorough control over yourself that you will be a person of poise. You are the product of at least a million years of evolutionary change. For countless generations preceding you, nature has been tempering and refining the materials that have gone into your makeup. Step by step, she has removed from the generations that have preceded you the animal instincts and baser passions until she has produced in you the finest specimen of animal that lives. She has endowed you, through this slow evolutionary process, with reason and poise and balance sufficient to enable you to control and to do with yourself whatever you will. No other animal has ever been endowed with such self-control as you possess. You have been endowed with the power to use the most highly organized form of energy known, that of thought. It is not improbable that thought is the closest connecting link there is between the material, physical things of this world and the world of divinity. You have not only the power to think, but what is 1,000 times more important still, you have the power to control your thoughts and direct them to do your bidding. We are coming now to the really important part of this lesson. Listen to the following meditatively. I approach this part of the lesson almost with fear and trembling, for it brings us face to face with a subject which but few are qualified to discuss with reasonable intelligence. I repeat, you have the power to control your thoughts and direct them to do your bidding. Your brain may be likened to a dynamo, in that it generates or sets into motion the mysterious energy called thought. The stimuli that start your brain into action are of two sorts. One is autosuggestion, and the other is suggestion. You can select the material out of which your thinking is produced, and that is autosuggestion, or self-suggestion. You can permit others to select the material out of which your thinking is produced, and that is suggestion. It is a humiliating fact that most thought is produced by the outside suggestion of others, and it is more humiliating still to have to admit that the majority of us accept this suggestion without either examining it or questioning its soundness. We read the daily newspapers as though every word were based upon fact. We are swayed by the gossip and idle chatter of others as though every word were true. Thought is the only thing over which you have absolute control. Yet, you permit other people to enter the sacred mansion of your mind and there deposit, through suggestion, their troubles and woes, adversities and falsehoods, just as though you did not have the power to close the door and keep them out. You have within your control the power to select the material that constitutes the dominating thoughts of your mind, and, just as surely as you're hearing these lines, those thoughts which dominate your mind will bring you success or failure according to their nature. The fact that thought is the only thing over which you have absolute control is of most profound significance. It strongly suggests that thought is your nearest approach to divinity on this earthly plane. Surely divine providence did not make thought the sole power over which you have absolute control without associating with that power potentialities which, if understood and developed, would stagger the imagination. Thought is your most important tool, the one with which you may shape your worldly destiny according to your own liking. Self-control is solely a matter of thought control. Please consider the foregoing sentence thoughtfully before going further, because it is, without doubt, the most important single sentence of this entire course. You are studying this course, presumably, because you are earnestly seeking truth and understanding sufficient to enable you to attain some high station in life. You are searching for the magic key that will unlock the door to the source of power, and yet you have the key in your own hands, and you may make use of it the moment you learn to control your thoughts. Place in your own mind, through the principle of auto-suggestion, the positive, constructive thoughts which harmonize with your definite chief aim in life, and that mind will transform those thoughts into physical reality and hand them back to you as a finished product. This is thought control. When you deliberately choose the thoughts that dominate your mind and firmly refuse admittance to outside suggestion, you are exercising self-control in its highest and most efficient form. Human beings are the only animals that can do this. How many millions of years nature has required in which to produce this animal, no one knows. But every intelligent student of psychology knows that the dominating thoughts determine the actions and the nature of the animal. The point I wish clearly to establish in this lesson is that thought, whether accurate or inaccurate, is the most highly organized functioning power of your mind, and that you are but the sum total of your dominating or most prominent thoughts. If you would be a master salesperson of goods or of personal services, you must exercise sufficient self-control to shut out all adverse arguments and suggestions. Most salespeople have so little self-control that they hear the prospective purchaser say no even before he says it. They have so little self-control that they actually suggest to themselves that their prospective purchaser will say no when asked to purchase their wares. How different is the person of self-control? He or she not only makes the self-suggestion that the prospective purchaser will say yes, but if the desired yes is not forthcoming, he or she stays on the job until the opposition breaks down. If the prospective purchaser says no, the person of self-control does not hear it. If the prospective purchaser says no to a second and a third and a fourth time, he or she does not hear it, for a person of self-control permits no suggestions to reach the mind except those which are invited. The master salesperson, whether he or she is engaged in selling merchandise or personal services or sermons or public addresses, understands how to control his or her own thoughts. Instead of being a person who accepts, with meek submission, the suggestions of others, the master salesperson is one who persuades others to accept his or her suggestions. The master salesperson becomes a dominating personality. This, too, is self-control. A master salesperson is one who takes the offensive and never the defensive side of an argument, if argument arises. If you are a master salesperson, you know that it is necessary for you to keep your prospective purchaser on the defensive. And you also know that it will be fatal to your sale if you permit the buyer to place you on the defensive and keep you there. You may, and of course you will at times, be placed in a position in which you will have to assume the defensive side of the conversation for a time. But it is your business to exercise such perfect poise and self-control that you will change places with your prospective purchasers without them noticing that you have done so. This requires the most consummate skill and self-control. Most salespeople sweep this vital point aside by becoming angry and trying to scare the prospective purchaser into submission. But the master of the craft remains calm and serene and usually comes out the winner. When I use the term salesperson, I mean all people who try to persuade or convince others by logical argument or appeal to self-interest. We are all salespeople, or at least we should be, no matter what form of service we are rendering or what sort of goods we are offering. The ability to negotiate with other people without friction and argument is the outstanding quality of all successful people. Observe those nearest you and notice how few there are who understand this art of tactful negotiation. Observe also how successful are the few who understand this art, despite the fact that they may have less education than those with whom they negotiate. It is a knack that can be cultivated. From the editors. An advertising representative for a magazine once received an angry call from one of his customers. The magazine's production department had placed incorrect information in a small ad, and the client was furious. For 10 minutes, he yelled and screamed. The ad rep was a master salesperson. He listened carefully to everything the client had to say. Then he interrupted with a simple statement. "You feel we hurt your business." Showing that he understood the customer's frustration, immediately gave him the offensive. He continued with, "I know you had big expectations from this ad, and that you feel your money has been wasted. I'd like to make it up to you. With your permission, we will correct the ad and run it again, but this time twice as large and at no charge." The rep's words continued to reinforce the value of his magazine service while presenting the customer with a proposition that was difficult to refuse. More significantly, however, the rep had gotten the customer to agree to a much larger ad. Of course, the first time it ran, the customer paid nothing for it. But the rep knew that once the customer experienced the business that the larger ad created, he would never go back to a small one. By exercising self-control in his dealings with an irate customer, the ad rep turned a potential disaster into a positive opportunity. Returning now to Napoleon Hill's original text. The art of successful negotiation grows out of patient and painstaking self-control. Notice how easily the successful salesperson exercises self-control when handling a customer who is impatient. The salesperson may be boiling inside, but you will see no evidence of it in manner or words. That person has acquired the art of tactful negotiation. A single frown of disapproval or a single word denoting impatience will often spoil a sale. Successful salespeople exercise self-control and, as a reward, they set their own salary and choose their own position. To watch those who have acquired the art of successful negotiation is an education in itself. Watch those public speakers who have acquired this art. Notice the firmness of step as they mount the platform. Observe the firmness of voice as they begin to speak. Study their facial expressions as they sweep the audience with the mastery of their arguments. These are people who have learned how to negotiate without friction. Study those physicians who have acquired this art as they walk into the sick room and greet their patients with a smile. The bearing, the tone of voice, the look of assurance clearly identify them as professionals who have acquired the art of successful negotiation. And their patients will tell you it makes them feel better the moment such a doctor enters the sick room. Watch the managers or supervisors who have acquired this art, and observe how their very presence spurs the employees to greater effort and inspires them with confidence and enthusiasm. Watch the lawyer who has acquired this art, and observe how he or she commands the respect and attention of the court. There is something about the tone of voice, the posture and expression, that causes opponents to suffer by comparison. All of this is predicated upon self-control, and self-control is the result of thought control. Deliberately place in your own mind the sort of thoughts that you desire there, and keep out of your mind those thoughts that others place there through suggestion, and you will become a person of self-control. This privilege of stimulating your mind with suggestions and thoughts of your own choosing is your prerogative, and if you will exercise this right, there is nothing within the bounds of reason that you cannot attain. Losing your temper, and with it your case or your argument or your sanity, marks you as one who has not yet familiarized himself with the fundamentals upon which self-control is based, and the chief one of these fundamentals is the privilege of choosing the thoughts that dominate the mind. A student in one of my classes once asked how one went about controlling one's thoughts when in a state of intense anger, and I replied, "In exactly the same way that you would change your manner and the tone of your voice if you were in a heated argument with a member of your family and heard the doorbell ring, warning you that company was about to visit you. You would control yourself because you would desire to do so." If you have ever been in a similar predicament where you found it necessary to cover up your real feelings and change the expression on your face quickly, you know how easily it can be done. You also know that it can be done because one wants to do it. Back of all achievement, back of all self-control, back of all thought control is that magic something called desire. It is no misstatement of fact to say that you are limited only by the depth of your desires. When your desires are strong enough, you will appear to possess superhuman powers to achieve. No one has ever explained this strange phenomenon of the mind, and perhaps no one ever will, but if you doubt that it exists, you have but to experiment and be convinced. If you were in a building that was on fire and all the doors and windows were locked, the chances are that you would develop sufficient strength with which to break down the average door because of your intense desire to free yourself. If you desire to acquire the art of successful negotiation, as you undoubtedly will when you understand its significance in relation to your achievement of your definite chief aim, you will do so, providing your desire is intense enough. Napoleon desired to become Emperor of France, and he did rule. Lincoln desired to free the slaves, and he accomplished it. The French desired that they shall not pass at the beginning of the World War, and they didn't pass. Edison desired to produce light with electricity, and he produced it, although he was many years in doing so. Roosevelt desired to unite the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans through the Panama Canal, and he did it. Demosthenes desired to become a great public speaker, and despite the handicap of a serious speech impediment, he transformed his desire into reality. Helen Keller desired to speak, and despite the fact that she was deaf, dumb, and blind, she spoke. John H. Patterson desired to dominate in the production of cash registers, and he did. Marshall Field desired to be the leading merchant of his time, and he did it. Shakespeare desired to become a great playwright, and despite the fact that he was only a poor, itinerant actor, he made his desire come true. Billy Sunday desired to quit playing baseball and become a master preacher, and he did. James J. Hill desired to become an empire builder, and despite the fact that he was only a poor telegraph operator, he transformed that desire into reality. Editor's comment. Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic. Mahatma Gandhi led India to independence. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. galvanized the civil rights movement. Mary Kay Ash built a business empire for women. Sam Walton became the richest man in America. Jackie Joyner Kersee won a string of Olympic gold medals. And no doubt, anyone listening to this could add the names of many other men and women, all of whom had a definite chief aim that they desired strongly enough to make it a reality. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. Don't say it can't be done, or that you are different from these and thousands of others who have achieved noteworthy success in every worthy calling. If you are different, it is only in this respect. They desire the object of their achievement with more depth and intensity than you desire yours. Plant in your mind the seed of a desire that is constructive by making the following your creed and the foundation of your code of ethics. I wish to be of service to others as I journey through life. To do this, I have adopted this creed as a guide to be followed in dealing with my fellow beings, to train myself so that never, under any circumstances, will I find fault with any person, no matter how much I may disagree with him or how inferior his work may be, as long as I know he is sincerely trying to do his best. To respect my country, my profession, and myself. To be honest and fair with others, as I expect them to be honest and fair with me. To be a loyal citizen of my country. To speak of it with praise, and act always as a worthy custodian of its good name. To be a person whose name carries weight wherever it goes. To base my expectations of reward on a solid foundation of service rendered. To be willing to pay the price of success in honest effort. To look upon my work as an opportunity to be seized with joy and made the most of, and not as a painful drudgery to be reluctantly endured. To remember that success lies within myself, in my own brain. To expect difficulties and to force my way through them. To avoid procrastination in all its forms, and never, under any circumstances, put off until tomorrow any duty that should be performed today. Finally, to take a good grip on the joys of life, so I may be courteous to others, faithful to friends, true to God, a fragrance in the path I tread. The energy that most people dissipate through lack of self-control would, if organized and used constructively, bring all the necessities and all the luxuries desired. The time that many people devote to gossiping about others would, if controlled and directed constructively, be sufficient to attain the object of their definite chief aim, if they had such an aim. All successful people grade high on self-control. All failures grade low, generally zero, on this important law of human conduct. Study those around you and observe, with profit, that all the successful ones exercise self-control, while the failures permit their thoughts, words, and deeds to run wild. One very common and very destructive form of lack of self-control is the habit of talking too much. People of wisdom, who know what they want and are bent on getting it, guard their conversation carefully. There can be no gain from a volume of uninvited, uncontrolled, loosely spoken words. It is nearly always more profitable to listen than it is to speak. A good listener may, once in a great while, hear something that will add to his stock of knowledge. It requires self-control to become a good listener, but the benefits to be gained are worth the effort. Taking the conversation away from another person is a common form of lack of self-control, which is not only discourteous, but it deprives those who do it of many valuable opportunities to learn from others. Self-control was one of the marked characteristics of all successful leaders whom I have analyzed in gathering material for this course. Luther Burbank said that, in his opinion, self-control was the most important of the 17 laws of success. During all his years of patient study and observation of the evolutionary processes of vegetable life, he found it necessary to exercise the faculty of self-control, despite the fact that he was dealing with inanimate life. John Burroughs, the naturalist, said practically the same thing, that self-control stood near the head of the list in importance of the 17 laws of success. The person who exercises complete self-control cannot be permanently defeated, as Emerson has so well stated in his essay on compensation, for the reason that obstacles and opposition have a way of melting away when confronted by the determined mind that is guided to a definite end with complete self-control. Every wealthy person whom I have analyzed, referring to those who have become wealthy through their own efforts, showed such positive evidence that self-control had been one of their strong points that I reached the conclusion that no one can hope to accumulate great wealth and keep it without exercising this necessary quality. The saving of money requires the exercise of self-control of the highest order, as, I hope, has been made quite clear in the fourth lesson of this course. Poverty. I am indebted to Edward W. Bach for the following rather colorful description of the extent to which he found it necessary to exercise self-control before he achieved success and was crowned with fame as one of the great journalists of America. Why I believe in poverty is the richest experience that can come to a boy. I make my living trying to edit the Ladies' Home Journal, and because the public has been most generous in its acceptance of that periodical, a share of that success has logically come to me. Hence, a number of my very good readers cherish an opinion that I have often been tempted to correct, a temptation to which I now yield. My correspondents expressed the conviction variously, but this extract from a letter is a fair sample. It is all very easy for you to preach economy to us when you do not know the necessity for it. To tell us how, as for example in my own case, we must live within my husband's income of $800 a year, when you have never known what it is to live on less than thousands. Has it occurred to you, born with the proverbial silver spoon in your mouth, that theoretical writing is pretty cold and futile compared to the actual hand-to-mouth struggle that so many of us live, day by day and year in and year out, an experience that you know not of? An experience that you know not of? Now, how far do the facts square with this statement? Whether or not I was born with the proverbial silver spoon in my mouth, I cannot say. It is true that I was born of well-to-do parents. But when I was 6 years old, my father lost all his means and faced life at 45 in a strange country without even necessaries. There are men and their wives who know what that means, for a man to try to come back at 45 and in a strange country. I had the handicap of not knowing one word of the English language. I went to public school and learned what I could. And sparse morsels they were. The boys were cruel, as boys are. The teachers were impatient, as tired teachers are. My father could not find his place in the world. My mother, who had always had servants at her beck and call, faced the problems of housekeeping that she had never learned nor been taught, and there was no money. So, after school hours, my brother and I went home, but not to play. After school hours meant for us to help a mother who daily grew more frail under the burdens that she could not carry. Not for days, but for years, we two boys got up in the gray, cold winter dawn when the beds feel so warm to growing boys, and we sifted the coal ashes of the day before his fire for a stray lump or two of unburned coal, and with what we had or could find, we made the fire and warmed up the room. Then we set the table for the scant breakfast, went to school, and directly after school we washed the dishes, swept and scrubbed the floors. Living in a three-family tenement, each third week meant that we scrubbed the entire three flights of stairs from the third story to the first, as well as the doorsteps and the sidewalk outside. The latter work was the hardest, for we did it on Saturdays, with the boys of the neighborhood looking on none too kindly, so we did it to the echo of the crack of the ball and the bat on the adjoining lot. In the evening, when the other boys could sit by the lamp or study their lessons, we two boys went out with a basket and picked up wood and coal in the adjoining lots, or went after the dozen or so pieces of coal left from the ton of coal put in that afternoon by one of the neighbors. With the spot hungrily fixed in mind by one of us during the day, hoping that the man who carried in the coal might not be too careful in picking up the stray lumps. An experience that I not know of? Don't I? At 10 years of age, I got my first job, washing the windows of a baker's shop at 50 cents a week. In a week or two, I was allowed to sell bread and cakes behind the counter after school hours for $1 a week, handing out freshly baked cakes and warm, delicious-smelling bread when scarcely a crumb had passed my mouth that day. Then, on Saturday mornings, I served a route for a weekly paper and sold my remaining stock on the street. It meant from 60 to 70 cents for that day's work. I lived in Brooklyn, New York, and the chief means of transportation to Coney Island at that time was the horse car. Near where we lived, the cars would stop to water the horses. The men would jump out and get a drink of water, but the women had no means of quenching their thirst. Seeing this lack, I got a pail, filled it with water and a bit of ice, and, with the glass, jumped on each car on Saturday afternoon and all day Sunday, and sold my wares at a cent a glass. And when competition came, as it did very quickly when other boys saw that a Sunday's work meant $2 or $3, I squeezed a lemon or two in my pail, my liquid became lemonade, and my price 2 cents a glass, and Sunday mint $5 for me. Then, in turn, I became a reporter during the evenings, an office boy at daytimes, and learned stenography at midnight. My correspondent says she supports her family of husband and child on $800 a year and says I have never known what that means. I supported a family of three on $6.25 a week, less than one half of her yearly income. When my brother and I combined brought in $800 a year, we felt rich. I have, for the first time, gone into these details in print that you may know, at first hand, that the editor of the Ladies' Home Journal is not a theorist when he writes or prints articles that seek to preach economy or that reflect a hand-to-hand struggle on a small or invisible income. There is not a single step, not an inch, on the road of direct poverty that I do not know of or have not experienced. And, having experienced every thought, every feeling, and every hardship that will come to those who travel that road, I say today that I rejoice with every boy who is going through the same experience. Nor am I discounting or forgetting one single pang of the keen hardships that such a struggle means. I would not today exchange my years of the keenest hardship that a boy can know or pass through for any single experience that could have come to me. I know what it means to earn, not a dollar, but to earn 2 cents. I know the value of money as I could have learned it or known it no other way. I could have been trained for my life work in no surer way. I could not have arrived at a truer understanding of what it means to face a day without a penny in hand, not a loaf of bread in the cupboard, not a piece of kindling wood for the fire, with nothing to eat, and then be a boy with the hunger of 9 or 10, with the mother frail and discouraged. An experience that I know not of? Don't I? I envy every boy who is in that condition and going through it. But, and here's the pivot of my strong belief in poverty as an undisguised blessing to a boy, I believe in poverty as a condition to experience, to go through, and then to get out of, not as a condition to stay in. That's all very well, some will say, easy enough to say, but how can you get out of it? No one can definitely tell another that. No one told me. No two persons can find the same way out. Each must find his way for himself. That depends on the boy. I was determined to get out of poverty, because my mother was not born in it, could not stand it, and did not belong in it. This gave me the first essential, a purpose. Then I backed up the purpose with effort and willingness to work, and to work at anything that came my way, no matter what it was, so long as it meant the way out. I did not pick and choose. I took what came and did it in the best way I knew how. And when I didn't like what I was doing, I still did it well while I was doing it. But I saw to it that I didn't do it any longer than I had to do it. I used every rung in the ladder as a rung to the one above. It meant effort, but out of the effort and out of the work came the experience, the upbuilding, the development, the capacity to understand and sympathize, the greatest heritage that can come to a boy. And nothing in the world can give that to a boy so that it will burn into him as will poverty. That is why I believe so strongly in poverty, the greatest blessing in the way of the deepest and fullest experience that can come to a boy. But, as I repeat, always as a condition to work out of, not to stay in. Thus ends the excerpt from Edward W. Bach's article appearing in Ladies' Home Journal. The Law of Retaliation. Before you can develop the habit of perfect self-control, you must understand the real need for this quality. Also, you must understand the advantages which self-control provides those who have learned how to exercise it. By developing self-control, you develop, also, other qualities that will add to your personal power. Among other laws that are available to the person who exercises self-control is the law of retaliation. You know what retaliate means. In the sense that we are using here, it means to return like for like, and not merely to avenge or to seek revenge, as is commonly meant by the use of this word. If I do you an injury, you retaliate at first opportunity. If I say unjust things about you, you will retaliate in kind, even in greater measure. On the other hand, if I do you a favor, you will reciprocate, even in greater measure, if possible. Through the proper use of this law, I can get you to do whatever I wish you to do. If I wish you to dislike me and to lend your influence toward damaging me, I can accomplish this result by inflicting upon you the sort of treatment that I want you to inflict upon me through retaliation. If I wish your respect, your friendship, and your cooperation, I can get these by extending to you my friendship and cooperation. On these statements, I know that we are together. You can compare these statements with your own experience, and you will see how beautifully they harmonize. How often have you heard the remark, "What a wonderful personality that person has"? How often have you met people whose personalities you coveted? The person who attracts you to him through his pleasing personality is merely making use of the law of harmonious attraction or the law of retaliation, both of which, when analyzed, mean that like attracts like. If you will study, understand, and make intelligent use of the law of retaliation, you will be an efficient and successful salesman. When you have mastered this simple law and learned how to use it, you will have learned all that can be learned about salesmanship. The first and probably the most important step to be taken in mastering this law is to cultivate complete self-control. You must learn to take all sorts of punishment and abuse without retaliating in kind. This self-control is a part of the price you must pay for mastery of the law of retaliation. When an angry person starts in to vilify and abuse you, justly or unjustly, just remember that if you retaliate in a like manner, you are being drawn down to that person's mental level. Therefore, that person is dominating you. On the other hand, if you refuse to become angry, if you retain your self-composure and remain calm and serene, you take the other fellow by surprise. You retaliate with the weapon with which he is unfamiliar. Consequently, you easily dominate him. Like attracts like. There's no denying this. Literally speaking, every person with whom you come in contact is a mental looking glass in which you may see a perfect reflection of your own mental attitude. As an example of direct application of the law of retaliation, let me cite an experience that I recently had with my two small boys, Napoleon Jr. and James. We were on our way to the park to feed the birds and squirrels. Napoleon Jr. had bought a bag of peanuts, and James had bought a box of Cracker Jack. James took a notion to sample the peanuts. Without asking permission, he reached over and made a grab for the bag. He missed, and Napoleon Jr. retaliated with his left fist that landed rather briskly on James' jaw. I said to James, "Now here, son, you didn't go about getting those peanuts in the right manner. Let me show you how to get them." It all happened so quickly that I hadn't the slightest idea when I spoke what I was going to suggest to James. Then I thought of the experiments we had been making in connection with the law of retaliation. So I said to James, "Open your box of Cracker Jack and offer your little brother some and see what happens." After considerable coaxing, I persuaded him to do this. Then a remarkable thing happened, a happening out of which I learned my greatest lesson in salesmanship. Before Napoleon would touch the Cracker Jack, he insisted on pouring some of his peanuts into James' overcoat pocket. He retaliated in kind. Out of this simple experiment with two small boys, I learned more about the art of managing them than I could have learned in any other manner. None of us has advanced far beyond Napoleon Jr. and James as far as the operation and influence of the law of retaliation is concerned. We are all just grown-up children and easily influenced through this principle. If a person presents us with a gift, we never feel satisfied until we have retaliated with something as good or better than that which we received. If a person speaks well of us, we increase our admiration for that person and we retaliate in return. Through the principle of retaliation, we can actually convert our enemies into loyal friends. If you have an enemy whom you wish to convert into a friend, you can prove the truth of this statement if you will forget that dangerous millstone hanging around your neck, which we call pride or stubbornness. Make a habit of speaking to this enemy with unusual cordiality. Go out of your way to favor him in every manner possible. He may seem immovable at first, but gradually he will give way to your influence and retaliate in kind. One morning in August 1863, a young clergyman was called out of bed in a hotel at Lawrence, Kansas. The man who called him was one of Quantrill's guerrillas, and he wanted him to hurry downstairs and be shot. All over the border that morning, people were being murdered. A band of raiders had ridden in early to perpetrate the Lawrence Massacre. The guerrilla who called the clergyman was impatient. The latter, when fully awake, was horrified by what he saw going on through his window. As he came downstairs, the gorilla demanded his watch and money, and then wanted to know if he was an abolitionist. The clergyman was trembling, but he decided that if he was to die then and there, it would not be with a lie on his lips. So he said that he was, and followed up the admission with a remark that immediately turned the whole affair into another channel. He and the gorilla sat down on the porch, while people were being killed through the town, and had a long talk. It lasted until the raiders were ready to leave. When the clergyman's gorilla mounted to join his Confederates, he was strictly on the defensive. He handed back the New Englander's valuables, apologized for disturbing him, and asked to be thought well of. That clergyman lived many years after the Lawrence Massacre. What did he say to the gorilla? What was there in his personality that led the latter to sit down and talk? What did they talk about? "Are you a Yankee abolitionist?" the gorilla had asked. "Yes, I am," was the reply, "and you know very well that you ought to be ashamed of what you're doing." This drew the matter directly to a moral issue. It brought the gorilla up roundly. The clergyman was only a stripling beside this seasoned border ruffian, but he threw a burden of moral proof onto the raider, and in a moment the latter was trying to demonstrate that he might be a better fellow than circumstances would seem to indicate. After waking this New Englander to kill him on account of his politics, he spent 20 minutes on the witness stand trying to prove an alibi. He went into his personal history at length. He explained matters from the time when he had been a tough little kid who wouldn't say his prayers, and became quite sentimental in recalling how one thing had led to another, and that led to something worse, until, well, here he was. And a mighty bad business to be in, partner. His last request in writing away was, "Now, partner, don't think too hard of me, will you?" The New England clergyman made use of the law of retaliation, whether he knew it at that time or not. Imagine what would have happened had he come downstairs with a revolver in his hand and started to meet physical force with physical force. But he didn't do this. He mastered the gorilla because he fought him with a force that was unknown to the brigand. Why is it that once you begin to make money, the whole world seems to be the pathway to your door? Take any person that you know who enjoys financial success, and he will tell you that he is being constantly sought and that opportunities to make money are constantly being urged upon him. To him that hath shall be given, but to him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. This quotation from the Bible used to seem ridiculous to me, yet how true it is when reduced to its concrete meaning. Yes, to him that hath shall be given. If he hath failure, lack of self-confidence, hatred, or lack of self-control, to him shall these qualities be given in still greater abundance. But if he hath success, self-confidence, self-control, patience, persistence, and determination, to him shall these qualities be increased. Sometimes it may be necessary to meet force with force, until we overpower our opponent or adversary. But while he is down is a splendid time to complete the retaliation by taking him by the hand and showing him a better way to settle disputes. It is for you to decide what you want others to do, and it is for you to get them to do it through the law of retaliation. The divine economy is automatic and very simple. How true it is that we receive only that which we give. It is not that which we wish for that comes back to us, but that which we give. I implore you to make use of this law, not alone for material gain, but better still, for the attainment of happiness and goodwill. This, after all, is the only real success for which to strive. In this lesson, we have learned a great principle, probably the most important major principle of psychology. We have learned that our thoughts and actions toward others resemble a magnet, which attracts us to the same sort of thought and the same sort of action that we ourselves create. We have learned that like attracts like, whether in thought or in action. We have learned that the human mind responds in kind to whatever thought impressions it receives. We have learned that the human mind resembles Mother Earth in that it will reproduce action that corresponds in kind to the sensory impressions planted in it. We have learned that kindness begets kindness, and unkindness and injustice beget unkindness and injustice. We have learned that our actions toward others, whether of kindness or unkindness, justice or injustice, come back to us, even in larger measure. We have learned that the human mind responds in kind to all sensory impressions it receives. Therefore, we know what we must do to influence any desired action upon the part of another. We have learned that pride and stubbornness must be brushed away before we can make use of the law of retaliation in a constructive way. We have not learned what the law of retaliation is, but we have learned how it works and what it will do. Therefore, it only remains for us to make intelligent use of this great principle. The Evolution of Transportation, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. Nothing is permanent except change. Time is ever shifting, changing, and rearranging both the stage setting and the players. New friends are constantly replacing the old. Every human being is both a criminal and a saint, depending on the expediency of the moment as to which will assert itself. Honesty and dishonesty are largely matters of individual viewpoint. The weak and the strong, the rich and the poor, the ignorant and the well-informed are exchanging places continuously. Know yourself, and you know the entire human race. There is but one real achievement, and that is the ability to think accurately. We move with the procession or behind it, but we cannot stand still. Nothing is permanent except change. The law of evolution is working out improvements in the methods of travel. Remember that all these changes took place first in the human mind. Man was not satisfied with the first crude method of transportation. Those two little words, not satisfied, have been the starting point of all advancement. Think of them as you listen. As the human brain began to expand, humans discovered how to hitch a bullock to a wagon and thereby escape the toil of pulling the load. That was practical utility. But when the stagecoach was ushered into use, that was both utility and style. Still, we were not satisfied, and this dissatisfaction ultimately created the crude locomotive. Now, these methods of travel have been discarded in almost all parts of the world. The man drawing the cart, the bullock drawing the cart, the stagecoach, and the crude locomotive all belong to ages that have passed. Think about the transportation methods of the present. Compare them with those of the past, and you may have a fair idea of the enormous expansion that has taken place in the human brain and mind. Automobiles that travel at great speed became as common as were the two-wheeled carts in ages past, and yet we were still not satisfied. Travel on the earth was too slow. Turning our eyes upward, we watched the birds soaring high in the elements and became determined to excel them. And so we mastered the sky. Not only has man made the air carry him at amazing speeds, but he has harnessed the ether and made it carry his words all the way around the earth in the fractional part of a second. Any influence that causes one to think causes one, also, to grow stronger mentally. Mind stimulants are essential for growth. From the days of the man-drawn cart to the present days of air mastery, the only progress that anyone has made has been the result of some influence that stimulated his mind to greater than normal action. The two great major influences that cause the human mind to grow are the urge of necessity and the urge of desire to create. Some minds develop only after they have undergone failure and defeat and other forms of punishment that arouse them to greater action. Other minds wither away and die under punishment, but grow to unbelievable heights when provided with the opportunity to use their imaginative forces in a creative way. Understand the evolution of transportation, and you will observe one outstanding fact worth remembering, namely, that the whole story has been one of development and advancement that grew out of necessity. Throughout the past, the urge to change was based on necessity. In the present, the urge has been a combination of both necessity and the desire to create. In the future, the strong desire to create will be the sole urge that will drive the human mind on and on to heights as yet undreamed of. It is a long distance from the days of the man-drawn cart to the present, when we have harnessed the lightning of the clouds and made it turn machinery that will perform as much service in a minute as 10,000 workers could perform in a day. But if the distance has been long, the development of man's mind has been correspondingly great, and that development has been sufficient to eventually do the work of the world with machines operated by nature's forces and not by human muscles. The evolutionary changes in the methods of transportation have created other problems for our minds to solve. The automobile drove us to build better roads and more of them. The automobile also claims thousands of lives annually. The human mind must now respond to the urge of necessity and meet this emergency. If you have a highly imaginative mind, you may be the one who will create the solution and collect the royalties from its sale. The value to you of this suggestion lies in the possibility of thought that you may devote to it, thereby developing and expanding your own mind. Remember, the purpose of this essay is to give you merely the seed of suggestion, not the finished product of an invention ready to set up and render service. Study yourself and find out to which of the two great major urges to action your mind responds most naturally, or the desire to create. If you have children, study them and determine to which of these two motives they respond most naturally. Millions of children have had their imaginations dwarfed and retarded by parents who removed as much as possible of the urge of necessity. By making it easy for your child, you may be depriving the world of a genius. Bear in mind the fact that most of the progress that humans have made came as the result of bitter, biting necessity. The law of evolution is always and everywhere at work, changing, tearing down, and rebuilding every material element on this earth and throughout the universe. Towns, cities, and communities are undergoing constant change. Go back to the place where you lived 20 years ago, and you will recognize neither the place nor the people. New faces will have made their appearance. The old faces will have changed. New buildings will have taken the place of the old. Everything will appear different because everything will be different. The human mind is also undergoing constant change. If this were not true, we would never grow beyond the child mind age. Every 7 years, the mind of a normal person becomes noticeably developed and expanded. It is during those periodical changes of the mind that bad habits may be left off and better habits cultivated. The mind that is driven by the urge of necessity, or out of love to create, develops more rapidly than does the mind that is never stimulated to greater action than that which is necessary for existence. The imaginative faculty of the human mind is the greatest piece of machinery ever created. Out of it has come every man-made machine and every man-made object. Behind every one of the great industries and commercial enterprises is the all-powerful force of imagination. Force your mind to think. Proceed by combining old ideas into new plans. Every great invention and every outstanding business or industrial achievement that you can name is, in final analysis, but the application of a combination of plans and ideas that have been used before in some other manner. Back of the beating hammer by which the steel is wrought, back of the workshop's clamor, the seeker may find the thought. The thought that is ever master of iron and steam and steel, that rises above disaster and tramples it under heel. The drudge may fret and tinker or labor with lusty blows, but back of him stands the thinker, the clear-eyed man who knows. For into each plow or saber, each piece and part and whole, must go the brains of labor, which gives the work a soul. Back of the motors humming, back of the bells that ring, back of the hammers drumming, back of the cranes that swing. There is the eye which scans them, watching through stress and strain. There is the mind which plans them, back of the brawn, the brain. Might of the roaring boiler, force of the engine's thrust, strength of the sweating toiler, greatly in these we trust. But back of them stands the schemer, the thinker who drives things through. Back of the job, the dreamer, who's making the dream come true. 6 months or a year from now, come back and listen to this essay again, and you will observe how much more you will get from it than you did the first time. Time gives the law of evolution a chance to expand your mind so it can see and understand more. This concludes the revised and updated edition of Volume 2 of The Law of Success.